Good morning, everyone. It is Thursday, March 27th, 2025. Welcome to the House Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. I will call it to order. A quorum is present. And I would take a motion for the approval of the minutes. Representative Mahmoud, have you had a chance to review the minutes? She's reviewing them quickly now.
Yes, Chair, I've had a minute to review the minutes, and I'd like to move them.
Right, perfect. Thank you, Representative Mahmoud. She has moved the minutes from March 25th, 2025. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes from March 25th, 2025 are adopted. The first bill we have on our agenda this morning. By the way, it's Representative Nolan West Day here at the Judiciary Committee. He's going to grow roots into that chair, I think, this morning. The first Representative West bill up today is House File 1027. And this bill was before us before we laid it over to ensure that there was no fiscal impact. There is no fiscal impact. And you will see in your packets there's also an A1 amendment. And members, we adopted that the first time the bill was in our possession. So the bill is in order. I will move House File 1027. And where's my motion? That it be passed and placed on the general register. Representative West, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1027 was one of the most lovely hearings I've ever had. So thank you to Chair Liebling and Representative Feist for your good comments on the bill. I never get tired of hearing that. It clarifies foreclosure surplus dealings that the sheriff has to deal with, as well as informing individuals who are being foreclosed upon what their rights are and what if they're entitled to a surplus, and clarifies how to distribute any surplus that is arranged in a sale to the relevant parties, whereas sheriffs have accidentally sent it to the wrong place because it was unclear and been sued and lost. This provides clarity for them, respects the rights, and enhances information for the foreclosees. So I appreciate the committee's support and am excited to see it on the general register.
Thank you, Representative West. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 1027? Seeing none, member questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1027, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You're on your way to the general register with House File 1027. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1915, and I will move House File 1915 before the committee. And the motion is, where did it go? That it be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families, Finance, and Policy, which is back to your committee, Chair West. I do see an A2. Would you like me to move the A2?
Yes,
all right.
Manager.
Members, I will move the A2. The A2 is before us. Representative West, can you tell us a little bit about what the A2 does?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in the time this bill has been sent to this committee, I have learned more than I ever cared to learn about data practices and whatnot, and having not served on judiciary.
It was fascinating, wasn't it?
Well, I love spending time with Chair Scott, so it was fascinating. This establishes role-based access, audit trails, and adds to a license inspection a audit of their compliance with this section. To respect the privacy and security of the data that is collected by these security cameras. And I would ask members to adopt it so we can begin discussion on the relevant portions of the bill to the committee.
Thank you, Representative West. That's a really good description. Any member discussion on the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. The bill is House File 1915 is the form that the author wishes. Go ahead and speak to your bill, Representative West.
Thank you, Chair Scott. And thank you to the Judiciary Committee. This bill, I actually didn't give as much thought to the data and the security and audit trails until having to come before this committee, which I guess is why it's a mandatory referral when we touch Chapter 13. So that is a good thing. However, I did think about it in relation to what cameras are being used. So this bill requires daycare centers to have cameras in their infant and toddler rooms, as well as cameras that observe all outdoor areas that are fenced in. And many daycare centers already have cameras currently, but in the case that really brought this up for me is my personal experience, well, my daughter's experience at a daycare center where she was abused. Yesterday, a plea agreement was reached with one of the abusers for 60 days in jail and 10 years probation. So we're moving on successfully to that. And she also admitted to every single, well, pled guilty to two felonies, but admitted to the abuse on all infants involved. So have some peace there. But one thing that I had that the detective stressed that I have stressed with this bill is the only reason that we made it to that point, the only reason these people are facing some sort of consequences, I'd argue not a high enough consequence, is because of the camera footage. However, they only kept the footage for a week. So despite a baby having their leg fractured on their watch, they did not get the felony conviction on fracturing the leg. And what? That is such a big deal. And they have a doctor's note. And the families, they've demonstrated the abuse over a long period of time. However, because it's not on video of that particularly happening, it wasn't convicted. And that's because it was beyond the week window. This bill expands it to 60 days. Originally, it was 90 days because 90 is better than 60. But then I realized that is a very expensive burden, and we also have to take that into account, which isn't something for this committee to determine the cost of that, but for children and families, where we're going to send this back to put in our omnibus bill, we have to make sure that this isn't adding to costs of already expensive, costly daycare. And the bill originally had cameras basically everywhere in the facility. We've narrowed it to specifically, and specifically infant and toddler rooms and where they play outside. And that's because they can't advocate for themselves. I had no idea what was happening to my daughter. And you never assume what's happening. And thank God, I never want to see the video. My daughter isn't on the week of video they have, but I would never want to see that happen. So as it pertains to this committee, some daycare centers use Wi-Fi cameras so that parents can observe their children remotely. This bill does not require Wi-Fi or closed circuit. There's been a discussion about requiring closed circuit. Closed circuit's what I'd recommend. The only reason this bill doesn't require closed circuit is because I think it would be a little bit unfair for the centers that do comply already to have to then switch out their cameras. But that is a discussion I think will continue to be had because I want this bill to become law. And I guess that's 1916. So that eliminates a significant security concern if they go with the closed circuit systems, which is what I'd recommend, because the Wi-Fi cameras are incredibly easy to break into. Any enterprising 16-year-old could do so. While they have control of the footage, it'll be role-based access. I imagine that will be directors and assistant directors, usually in a daycare center situation. And the software you can use for this 90-day retention, they have many different logging systems that can work on compliance with this audit trail amendment that came in so that it doesn't add additional costs. The 60-day retention period is very affordable. I couldn't find an affordable option for 90 days, but 60 days is really important. I talked to the department as well about having enough time to prove the fraud crime. This also requires the center to have a written policy on the locations monitored by these cameras so that families are aware whether they, the areas where their children will be are monitored by cameras. I actually think it's kind of strange to be concerned about being monitored by cameras for your children, because that's, with my experience, that's the only way you'd ever get justice if something happens. But even so, your children can be seen in Target. A weirdo can sit in a public parking lot and film your children as they go into the facility. But we do want to make sure these cameras are secure. So with the role-based access and audit trails, and now with the inspectors also checking with checking that these centers are complying with these requirements, we can ensure the data is secured. The only time the data is accessible outside of a police investigation is if there's a disciplinary action where the footage is being used on an employee, they are entitled to have access to the footage because it's evidence against them in some sort of disciplinary proceeding. The other time when data is, the video is able to be seen but not transmitted, only viewed, they do not obtain a copy of, is when a parent's child has been harmed at the center and that harm is documented. So what that means is they brought their child for treatment from a doctor, and the doctor has indicated that there was harm caused. There is visible bruises or marks that persist for more than 24 hours. And there was one more. I've said this so many times. Or there's a physical impediment, like a limp, that is all didn't exist previously. Obviously, that'd be a massive concern for any parent. So they are able to view the footage. They are not able to have a copy of it. The center also, centers also asked for language that allowed them to use footage for training. And that is also, that is in here with a specific requirement that they need to redact any identifying information of individuals in the room unless they have signed a specific consent form. I believe I have covered everything related to the committee, and I am happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Chair West. I believe there are some testifiers. I have three testifiers that have signed up. The first one is Janice DeGonda, and on deck is Suzanne Dickinson. If you could both come up to the testifiers table, we can keep this thing running smoothly. And then when Janice is finished, we will have Josh Truax come up. So, Janice, you're the first one. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Janice DeGonda, and before I get into it, I just wanted to thank Representative Nolan for all the changes that he's trying to make, as well as Representative Feist and Chair Liebling for co-authorizing this bill. I have a one-year-old daughter who was also abused at the daycare as Representative West's. At the time of the abuse, she was 5 months old, but gestationally she was 3 months old, as I had to deliver 2 months early due to severe preeclampsia. After 37 days in the NICU, learning how to be first-time parents to a premature baby, we were finally able to bring her home, which then she had to attend daycare a few weeks later. We found the daycare and appreciated the security of the building, the small classroom ratios, and that they had cameras, as having cameras was a big factor for us. After a month attending, our daughter started coming home with bruises, abrasions, or scratches. Every time we noticed a mark, we would ask the daycare about it. We were always told the same thing. She must be getting pinched from the infant swing clip. The Velcro from her sleep sack caused the scratch. Her infant chair caused it, her nails being too long, or just being told that they did not see what caused it, so that they did not know. And at the time, those seemed like likely excuses. We did not think about questioning it too much, as these were people paid to protect my child, along with all the other children, and that there were cameras. Surely if something was wrong, it would be noticed. We thought that the cameras were being watched closely to protect the children attending the daycare in all the rooms. We then had a phone conversation with the director in June about our concerns. She kept coming home with marks, and they kept having issues feeding her, so much so that we brought her to the doctor to see if she had infant GERD. After that conversation, the marks suddenly stopped until July. We did not notice the significant bruising until we were home and doing a diaper change, as that they were covered by her clothes. They were on her legs, her stomach, her groin, and her butt. This is what caused us to bring her to the hospital to get checked out and what started this investigation. We received a phone call from the detective doing the investigation who let us know that our daughter was seen on camera along with two other babies being abused. Then to find out that the daycare only kept the footage for a week at a time. This is highly unacceptable. As Chairman Representative West mentioned, the detective yesterday said that without this footage, we would not be where we are, and we would not already have the plea for one of the abusers. The camera footage needs to be kept longer, if not for abuse reasons, but simply for training opportunities for the staff. If this daycare had kept it for much longer, I am certain that this investigation would not be still ongoing. There are over a dozen families involved with this case, but only five of us with charges as due to having the footage. And some families aren't even able to get charges added on due to having no video evidence. There would be more charges, more families with questions answered, and more families getting justice for their children. We need to be able to feel safe that our children are safe when they are not in our care. And if questions arise on their safety, we need to be able to see what is going on. We must protect them at all costs, and this is the start of doing so. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. DeGonda. I am so sorry this happened to your baby, and it's unconscionable. And I'm a new Nana of two, both of whom are 3 months old, and I can't even imagine treating a vulnerable little baby like that. Thank you for your testimony, and I hope that justice is served here. Our next testifier is Suzanne Dickinson. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Suzanne Dickinson. I am Janice DeGonda's mother and the Nana of her daughter. As I prepare for these days, all I feel is anger. Everywhere we go today, we are on some kind of a video. Cameras have proved crimes or disproved crimes. I was truly shocked to learn that daycares are not required to even have cameras. My granddaughter was abused at Small World Learning Center last July. She was 9 weeks premature and did not even weigh 4 pounds. She was 5 months old when the worst of the abuse was reported to police and child protection while we were at the emergency room with her. The daycare was aware she was to be treated as a 3-month-old, premature, immobile infant. We are fortunate that the most severe incident was obtained by the police while we were still at the hospital, more so because it deletes after 7 days. In the police report and court cases, my granddaughter is referred to as Infant One. To me, she's my heart, my namesake, and as I call her, my little bird. We hope to see justice done to her abusers. Again, as everyone has said, we were told yesterday, if not for the video, there would be no charges at all. My granddaughter could have had permanent brain damage from being hit, her head on the floor. Due to deletion of video after a week, we'll never truly know of all the other incidents of abuse. And then my anger rises as I know there are over a dozen other victims in the case who don't even have hope of any kind of justice. The unknown has personally caused me nightmares since her abusers were arrested. Having the opportunity to review incidents causing injury should be available for parents because that unknown is hell to live with. Remembering these victims are unable to do anything except cry and scream in fear and pain, I ask all of you to please help by mandating cameras to support the children and the workers so they are not wrongly accused. The length of said video should be kept and giving the parents the right to see it. Thank you, Representative Feist and Chair Liebling, for co-authoring this bill. And thank you, Representative West, for letting us even speak and make something out of this.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Truax, go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Joshua Truax. Thank you, Judiciary Committee and Representative Nolan West, for having me here today. I wrote my speech on my phone.
That's fine.
If I stare down a lot, I apologize. My name is Josh, and my son was enrolled in a facility where he was verbally abused and physically manhandled on February 6th of this year, while 19 other children were there to witness these repeated acts on almost a daily basis. I am here today because I and others recognize an urgent need for reform in our daycare system, an industry entrusted with the well-being of our youngest and most vulnerable children, and the safety of our children is not just a priority, it's a fundamental right. Yet time and again, we hear heartbreaking stories of neglect, mistreatment, and abuse within daycare facilities, such as what happened to my son on February 6th and last July at Small World. The unfortunate truth is that without proper oversight, these violations too often go unseen and unaddressed. It's time for real change. It's time for accountability, and I'm calling on you guys to help make a difference today. One of the most effective tools to protect our children and provide transparency is the installation of camera with audio at minimum in all baby and toddler rooms. These early years are the most crucial in a child's development, yet infants and toddlers cannot speak for themselves. With recorded footage, we empower parents, facility directors, and authorities to ensure that every child is receiving the care that they deserve. Daycare safety does not stop at the classroom doors. Outdoor play areas are common places for injuries, accidents, and potential misconduct. By requiring cameras in these spaces, we provide an extra layer of protection and ensure that no corner of a daycare facility becomes a blind spot for mistreatment or harm. Parents deserve the peace of mind that comes with knowing their child is in a safe and nurturing environment. By allowing parents to review footage upon request, we are not only fostering trust, but encouraging daycares to uphold the highest standards of care. A responsible daycare should have nothing to hide. This measure is not about micromanaging. It's about ensuring that every child is treated with the respect and kindness that they deserve. Requiring footage to be retained for at least 60 days and extending that period to 6 months if injuries occur is a crucial safeguard against injustice. Too often, concerns arise weeks after an incident, and without video evidence, the truth remains elusive. This policy will ensure that proper investigations can take place, preventing abusers from escaping accountability, while also allowing innocent caregivers to clear their names when wrongly accused. In conclusion, we must ask ourselves this: what kind of society do we want to build for our children? One where mistreatment is hidden behind closed doors? Sorry. Or one where transparency and accountability are non-negotiable? By implementing these common sense reforms, cameras with audio, outdoor surveillance, parental access, and extended footage retention, we are taking a powerful stand for our children's safety and well-being. Let us not wait for another tragic story to spur us into action. Let's act now, and for the sake of our children and for the peace of mind of every parent who entrusts a daycare with their most precious gift. In comparison to the testimonies here today, they stated that their center retained video footage for a week. Mine was 5 days. Please support House File 1915.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not the first time that's happened. I want to thank you for bringing this bill and the other bills that you've brought. I have a story that I've never shared publicly before, but my son, when he was two, had marks from a daycare center. We reported it, and they claimed that he was fell out of a little toddler house and that he got stuck, and that's what caused the marks. They were fingerprints. And had the cameras been in place in his room, I'm sure that we could have moved ahead with holding the people accountable who did that. I'll just note, too, that we put cameras in assisted living facilities, or allowed for the use of cameras in assisted living facilities, and I've heard that it's been extremely helpful. And so I feel like when there are vulnerable populations, like elders who might be in assisted living facilities, or children, it really makes a lot of sense. So I'll be signing on to your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Really briefly.
On the assisted living, that's also where trying to figure out what was reasonable for retention. The retention rates are much longer in those facilities than in the other.
Thank you.
It's a natural thing.
Do you want the last one?
Sure.
Representative Feist.
I'm not near my mic. Thank you so much, Chair West, for all of your work on this bill. The situation, you know, that at your daycare also impacted a family from my community, and I'm grateful that you reached out to me and invited me into your process. I had the opportunity to sit in on pretty intense listening session, but, you know, it was really important feedback that, you know, created the framework for this bill, and to see all of the additional work that you've done to make sure that it's workable and can achieve its goals, and then appreciate all the audit trails and data. The data nerds in judiciary appreciate that. So I'm so sorry for what your family has gone through, and thank you for working so hard to find a legislative solution to protect other children.
Thank you. Representative Liebling, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative West, I'm so proud to be a co-author on the bill, and thank you, and I wanted to sign on to your bill just because, you know, when you're a parent, and, you know, I've sent kids to different kinds of daycare, and now I have grandchildren who've gone to different kinds of daycare. I mean, being a parent is like having your heart be outside your body walking around. And it's pretty terrifying when your child goes off somewhere without you, especially when they don't have the ability to tell you what's going on. And so that's why I was really compelled to sign on to your bill. And as Representative Feist said, thank you so much for working on the details of this to make the bill better. I think it's important for us to acknowledge, even though we're the data committee here and not the child care committee, but we know that most child care providers are not abusing children, and they are good. But we do have this problem that we are sending our very vulnerable, precious young kids into somebody else's care. And I'm so glad you're working on this bill, and I appreciate it so much. But I hope that we can find ways to actually expand this, because any child going to the care of someone they're not related to really needs the same protection. And I'm also a little, when my kids or my grandkids have been in a daycare where the parents could check in on them in real time, that's something that I would really love to see. And I know there's technical issues. I know there are all kinds of problems in this space. I know there are cost issues. I appreciate that your committee is going to work on this some more and figure out how to make this work. But, you know, having the ability for parents to look in real time is more toward the prevention even. I mean, that's something I'm struggling with a little bit here. We do need to have the be able to catch it. You know, thank God in your case, you know, somebody is not going to be there abusing more children. That is prevention too. And I'm so glad that we have the ability to prosecute that, but I would also love to see a situation where parents can check in real time and watch their child randomly, and that would be, to me, an even better way to prevent this from happening. And I know a lot of parents would love to have that comfort to be able to do that. So anyway, I just wanted to make those comments and really appreciate your working to try to get the data pieces figured out. And I know this has a lot more figuring out to do, because I saw some of the, you know, comments from daycare providers, and we do have to make it work. And I know daycare is an extraordinarily complicated area, which is why it has a committee focused on it. So just thank you so much for all your work on this.
Chair West, I too thank you for your work on this, and I want to thank Mr. Hopkins for getting the amendment and everything in the shape that it is today. And, you know, our prayer is that no other kid is ever abused, but at least we have some safeguards now, and we can maybe some parents that have questions about how bruises showed up will have some answers now. With that, any final comments? Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all the comments and support. It is very much appreciated. On the Wi-Fi access is just a very difficult thing to manage securely. And actually, we'll have a little bit of discussion on what it's like to transmit data in the next bill, 1916, or with whatever, I forget the order we were doing. But I cannot say, like, this has been an awful situation, but I also feel so lucky that I get to do something about it. It's good for my mental state, and I feel privileged to be able to help other people express, because I'm sure a lot of people have contacted their representatives and just goes into the ether because we're busy and whatnot, but it's been an honor to be able to give a voice to more than just myself. But thank you for the support.
Thank you, Chair West. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 1915, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. You're on your way back to your own committee. The next bill before us is House File 1916. I will move that House File 1916 be recommended be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families, Finance, and Policy. Let me grab the bill. And I believe we have an amendment as well for that one, the A11. And I will move the A11. Representative West, or Chair West, can you tell us a little bit about the A11?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a similar amendment to the first one. This bill is a little different because it involves the government storing and having the data for a period of time, so it required further classification. It includes the compliance checks and audit trails. One difference in that is this bill has a $1 million threshold and above are affected for centers, and $1 million of early learning scholarship and above are affected for any daycare provider, not just centers. Misspoke there. So some of those are licensed differently, so they wouldn't have their audit during a license check. However, at this current moment, none of those unlicensed facilities qualify based on not having met the threshold for this bill to trigger.
Mm-hmm.
But this puts some guardrails around the data, and would appreciate getting in the shape I would like it.
Is there any discussion on the A11? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A11, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A11 is adopted. The bill is in the shape that Chair West would like it. Do we have any testifiers on this bill? Doesn't look like it. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, very good. We'll move to member questions.
Can I present the bill?
Oh, yes, please do.
Thank you.
I'm trying to rush things along here a little bit too much here, Chair West. Go ahead.
House File 1916 is another camera bill related to daycares. This one is more narrow in scope. The other one recovered every single center. This covers daycare providers or child care providers that take $1 million or more in CCAP money or $1 million or more in early learning scholarship money. If you're wondering, I believe the number is 73 facilities this would cover. The vast majority, if not all of those, do already have cameras, so there is less of a cost burden, especially considering these are facilities that have over $1 million in state subsidy, not counting any other monies coming in from private individuals. What this bill does is with those cameras, now we would love to offer live access to the department for the anti-fraud purposes, which is the crux of this bill. However, we run into the issue of security there again. So what this gives the commissioner the ability to, well, the mandate to pull data at least twice a year. And the cameras in this bill are focused on the entrances to the facility and where parents check in their child. The idea is coupled with the real-time access to attendance records, which are in towards the end of the bill. This allows the department to remotely verify that when these facilities apply for reimbursements, that the kids that are there are actually there. What we've seen in a recent KSTP story by Jay Coles is showed up to one of the centers, which are covered under this, multiple times, different times a day, didn't find any children. yet that particular center was getting over $1 million a year in CCAP, which is tied to children actually being at your facility. So it's a, the original edition of this bill had extra licensing inspection visits, and that was definitely going to make the fiscal note a behemoth. So moving to this remote monitoring approach allows for a lot more cost-effective verification of these activities, and focusing on a million or more, it's over, these 73 centers account for $108 million of taxpayer subsidy, just these 73. So it's a good targeted way to keep an eye on a pretty sizable amount of money and in a cost-effective way. I've also taken technical assistance from the department to refine the bill further. And one of those things, I was moving around the duration they had to keep the footage, ended on 60, like the other bill, because that is the longest affordable option. And the department made the case that we can't do much with anything less for proving long-term fraud. Lastly, the bill reinstates what used to exist, penalty of perjury when submitting your reimbursement request to the state. That was existing law up until 2013, and this reinstates that. That was a recommendation from the legislative auditor, because they mentioned when they were examining CCAP, they saw a lot of vulnerabilities, but the problem was actually pointing out to how this is fraud beyond the shadow of a doubt, and the penalty of perjury will help us get there. Yeah, I think I covered it.
All right. Thank you, Chair West. I'll ask again, anyone in the public wishing to testify? Seeing no one, any member questions? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you, Representative West, for your work on this and on the previous bill. I'm terribly sorry for what has happened to your family. Thank you to the testifiers who came to share. I'm terribly sorry for what happened to your family. This is obviously necessary work that we have to do. I just feel like I have to put on the record, you know, my family and children, we didn't go to a daycare center because we couldn't afford it. According to the numbers, somewhere between 80 and 90% of children in America do not go to daycare centers. They're priced out. We send our kids to in-home family care centers. There we have generally one adult who takes care of the kids, sometimes 1.5. And this is in no way intended to criticize the work that we've done here today, but I just think we really have to recognize that almost all of our kids will not have this protection. Almost all of our kids are in centers or in daycare providing spaces that will not have these cameras and these safety mechanisms, and that's a real problem for me. You know, we bounced around from in-home to in-home to try to find something that was comfortable, to find something where we felt safe and for the long term. And I know how hard it is to find spaces. It's very competitive. It's extremely expensive. Centers are three times generally more expensive than an in-home care center. So I want to make sure that we're just remembering all of our children when we have these conversations. Happy to support this. I think it's important. We'll do it. But that's been weighing on me today. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Chair West, comments?
That was obviously thought about. That is a glaring thing here. Representative Feist and I had an experience where we received input on that particular extending it to everyone, which was not a wonderful experience, but it was educational. But that isn't the only reason. That's part of the reason, though. A big part of this is when a center has a maltreatment case, and especially without footage, fire the employee, move on with their day. Like, no center wants it, but as far as actually having a serious cost, they have a maltreatment violation on their license. It's not good, but like their business still operates. Whereas family care provider, when those maltreatment investigations happen, basically they don't survive. The business doesn't survive. So that to me, helps target where we're not seeing accountability in these maltreatment things. But I do recognize your comments.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. And I know that you had thought about that. You know, I'm not accusing you of not recognizing that. I recognize that. It just felt really important to me to get that into our conversation here, because we are talking about a small portion of our kids in child care. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Representative Finke. And Chair West, you and Chair Katiza Watun have your work cut out for you in your committee, because we have a shortage of daycare that drives the price up. The regulations drive the price up. And we don't want to, it's a balancing act, and it's hard to find that sweet spot. And I want to thank you again for your work on this bill. And, you know, one of the things in the back of my mind with all the video footage and everything, and why I wanted to add these protections is with deep fake and all these different things now, I just want to make sure that our kids' footage of the most vulnerable of our kids isn't being caught by the wrong people and put out there in a very horrible way. So we will do what we can to by putting some belts and suspenders on the data. And again, thank you for bringing the bills. Was there any other member comments? Okay, closing remarks, Chair West.
Working with the department gave technical assistance on this bill, and they're very interested because they currently do monitor facilities with cameras when they're doing fraud investigations. So this does have a role that the department sees. So we're hopeful that we can find something that works perfectly to move forward with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair West. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 1916 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families Finance and Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 1916 is passed and re-referred to your committee, Chair West. The next bill on our agenda is House File 2226. And I will move House File 2226. This is an informational only bill hearing. And with that, Chair West, if you would like to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this informational hearing. The committee report didn't quite go through quickly, which this was supposed to be before the committee and is not. This bill does require further discussion, but back, this is a what I do now is go neck deep into depressing topics. And this one thing when you're looking into maltreatment, you hear from providers usually say something like, we didn't know that this person was like this, which is completely understandable. They only get qualified or unqualified in their background studies. This bill is an effort to expand those background studies so that we can be more proactive about preventing those who shouldn't be around kids to be around kids. So the other bills, which I think is a critique that is valid, is, well, these are about after the fact. These aren't preventing anything. I'd say the cameras do prevent a little, but I acknowledge that argument. That's more about accountability on the back end. This is an effort to get on the front end and prevent these abuse cases from happening in the first place. And the goal is to give providers more certainty when they are making these hires. We're also working with the BCA and interested in the department to make sure that the final copy of this bill, when it does move forward, will be something that is a 100% workable and provides additional safety for our children. So without that, I think our testifiers can go.
Thank you, Chair West. The first testifier I have on the list is Caitlin Simmons. Go ahead and state your name and proceed.
Hi, yeah, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Caitlin Simon, and I live in Southwest Minneapolis with my husband and two children. I'm testifying today because I want to protect my children and all other children in Minnesota. I am sure many of you are parents, grandparents, aunts, or uncles. You or someone close to you has probably had to search for care for their children. As caregivers, we want the best, and most importantly, the safest option for our children. We research all of our options. We ensure the daycare has all the right certifications. We drop our children off every workday, sometimes wiping away their tears, reassuring our children they are going to have a great day. But how would you feel if one of the teachers you entrusted with your child was arrested for possession of child sexual assault material? My husband and I, and unfortunately too many parents, have had to live this devastating experience over the last several months. Last August, we learned our children's former daycare teacher was arrested for possession and production of CSAM. When I saw the email and found the arrest details online, I felt my stomach drop. How could I grapple with what that meant? What did this mean for my daughter or the other children in this teacher's care for the last 3 years? How do you go back to work and all the tasks of the day when it feels like the ground has moved from under you? Within an instant, I had so many questions, worries, anger, and fear. My daughter had been in this teacher's classroom for 10 months when she was around 2 years old. This is someone who helped change my daughter's diapers and helped with toilet training. My daughter didn't like this teacher. I told her it was okay because I trusted the facility and the systems they rely on would never put my daughter in harm's way. I don't know if my child was directly harmed. I might never know. But what I am certain of is that this could have been prevented, especially for kids more directly harmed at a center more recently. To be clear, I don't blame the child care center, but I've lost trust in the systems that does the background checks and vets workers. I've lost trust in those who did not investigate the alerts from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's early warning systems meant to catch this predator. He was known to the data systems available to law enforcement and should have been known to the child care center, but they were told he was safe. The system failed my daughter and failed us. He could have been caught at least 5 different instances when applying to work at a new facility. This legislation will ensure that any future person like him will be caught. The reality and hard truth is we cannot go back. We cannot stop what happened to my daughter. What we can do is make sure no other parent has to worry about if their child is going to be safe. What we can do is make sure a child isn't harmed in this way ever again. If this isn't passed into law, there is nothing to stop it from happening again. So I'm asking the committee to support the passage of Bill HF2226.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next testifier at the table is Mr. Murphy. Go ahead and state your name for the record and continue on.
Thank you. My name is Huang Murphy. Good morning. I'm the CEO of People Serving People. We are the state's largest family homeless shelter. We serve over 400 folks each night, 70% of which are children. We also employ 130 people, all of which need background checks, and 40 of which work at our child care centers, which we have 2. I'm here today because I was approached by a group of parents that told me that something terrible happened and that they wanted to fix it. And as someone who runs a child care center, I also want to fix it. But I also want to be here because I want to be sure that the 130 people that I employ are safe, that the 300 children in my building are also safe. And right now, I don't think I can say that, not with the certainty that I would like. And that's because we have a dangerous gap in our child care background check system, one that has already put far too many children at risk, harmed potentially up to 200 that we know of just from one single case, and it will continue to do so if we don't act. So currently, the Minnesota Department of Human Services background checks do not check against the system, do not check against all known data and available data that law enforcement has. We are not asking that any details be shared that are inappropriate. We're not asking that folks move mountains, but we are asking that if someone is known to you, that we bar them from being in a vulnerable position with children. I do not think that is too much to ask, and I do think that is a basic expectation that people already assume is being done, and it's not. We can stop that. So if, and I just want to make that super clear, if someone has possession of child sexual abuse material, whether they have been charged yet, but if we know that they have it, they should not be working near children. This could have been prevented. This could have been stopped if government just spoke to government, if we just shared data. And there will be lots of folks that will say, oh, this is a process issue. Well, in simpler terms, it's just bad government getting in the way of good government. We're just asking that you talk to each other. And I have no power to prevent this. I have no power to stop this, but all of you do. So I'm begging for your help. Let's stop this from ever happening again. And let's be able to guarantee children that they're going to be okay. And their parents, the certainty that they need so that they can trust us and our child care centers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Thank you for the services that you provide. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, let's move to member questions. Any member questions? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative West, for bringing this. And thank you to your testifiers, both of them, for sharing your stories and for telling us that you want this. It wasn't but a couple of months ago that my wife, who's right now at home with our almost year-old son, and she is operating her small business while providing daycare services, which we sought elsewhere. We wanted to go and look for a place to bring our son, but citing these sorts of cases, we decided against it. And she kind of put her foot down and said, no, I'd rather work a full day's work and watch after him than put him into the hands of somebody that we don't know if they have a history like this. And so this seems like it would not only benefit the child care centers and their bottom line, more folks would be willing to go and place their kid there, but it's obviously rest assured for parents who couldn't ever sleep at night knowing that that they were subject to this. So thank you so much for bringing this forward, and I'll be signing on.
Any other? Oh, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill, and I wanted to thank Mr. Murphy for the really wonderful work that you do at People Serving People. I've had the privilege to tour several times, and the care that you put into providing a safe, nurturing environment for the most vulnerable people in our community is just really remarkable. So thank you. And thank you for then coming to the legislature and saying that every kid in the state of Minnesota deserves these protections. So thank you for this great bill.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Any other member questions? Or Chair Liebling.
Thank you very much. I just wonder, is this bill, since it's just informational today because it didn't get referred to us, Chair West, what's the path of this bill? Is it going to go to public safety also? And so I understand there's just some issues about, you know, how workable it is and so on, and just kind of wondering what's going to happen with it.
Chair West.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Chair Liebling. This bill has to go, to public safety, obviously, which, and then it also, because it deals with background studies, which is staying within Human Services, will have to go to Human Services as well. And then missing this committee is truly suboptimal with the committee report situation, but it does elevate the discussion and let us work on getting something. There is public information out there to do more, and we're trying to figure out the best way to do that. And all stakeholders, I think, are invested in making that happen. But it is going to travel through many committees.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you for that. And you know, clearly, you know, going back to just what we're talking about here, how vulnerable these, you know, these folks are. We, of course, want to use every available piece of information to make sure that people are safe. But, you know, sadly, you're never 100% sure because some people, you know, people do something for the first time. And that's why it just kind of, all these bills kind of work together, don't they? I mean, I still really like the idea of having parents be able to have real-time vision into what's happening in the room, because I think that's probably your best, you know, assurance, because there's never 100% assurance, right? That's kind of, in a way, that's sort of the way life is. And it's a sad and scary world, and we need to absolutely plug every hole that we can. And we need to, and I know you are trying to approach this issue from lots of different angles, because it absolutely deserves that. And especially, I think, going back to what Representative Finke said too, we need to make sure that we're thinking about all of the children who are vulnerable and all of the families that need this kind of assurance. And of course, this bill, I think, helps to do that, right? This is, well, let me just ask you, I mean, this applies to the people who are doing daycare in their homes as well, am I right? Or is it just daycare centers?
Chair West.
Yeah, it applies. So not just the people doing daycare in their homes, but to have a daycare in your home, you also need to have anybody who is in your home, even teenagers, have to go through background studies. And sadly, even teenagers have been found to be unfit to be around children.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, the world is nasty sometimes.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Chair Rarick.
Either way, thank you, Chair. I apologize. I was doing another bill hearing, so maybe this was said, but I'll just ask Chair Scott. Did the BCA come up and say what was in this background study? Because, you know, we've got over 100 different types of background studies, just to say what's in it and maybe what's not in it. I guess I'm more interested in what's not. I see the summary of what's in it, but I'm trying to go through my Rolodex of things in my head, like what isn't in it. I'm wondering, did they already testify to that?
Chair Rarick, they have not. They are in the room. At the risk of putting them on the spot, Mr. Evans, if you'd want to come to the table and address Chair Rarick's concerns, that would be awesome. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Chair Rarick. For the record, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. You're making me go through my Rolodex, because this really is within the purview of the Department of Human Services. We've had a couple of conversations with them about this. They check a variety of sources, and it's kind of, this is a background study that's conducted by the Department of Human Services. There's basic things that are in a lot of background checks, a check of the BCA, both state and federal criminal histories, that they receive the full information there. But there's also additional that, depending on where it is, if they lived out of the state, they do checks within the locality. If they're within Minnesota, they receive different information along the way. Look for maltreatment reports, since it's with children, etc. There's a variety of items that are looked at. You know, I would applaud the work at Chair West that's being done in terms of trying to figure out ways to strengthen background studies in this particular area. Our children are obviously our most precious resource, and doing everything we can to protect them when they're in somebody else's care, we certainly look forward to supporting. One of the things is a bit referenced here that's challenging with this is some federal prohibitions about the specifics. So we're meeting and continuing to look for ways to share relevant information that might be available or what the path would be. And our commitment is certainly to continue working with everybody at Department of Human Services and everybody here, because we never want to see a situation like was shared by the mother in that terrible situation that occurred. So we're continuing to figure out what we can do moving forward on this and what additional information we might be able to add. To your point specifically, that is not part of it now. We have another meeting with the Department of Human Services tomorrow morning, continuing to try to figure out a path forward.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's comforting. I have had myself a very important little child in my life that at age two was molested, and that person was known to be a molester. So I And she was not verbal at 2, but she was at 3, and she told the story. So you just never know. Anyway, so I see you have on here the Predatory Offender Registry, which is good, and all the things that you just listed. So I'm glad that they're working on it, because I don't want to miss something, because this is incredibly important to protect the most vulnerable. When they're infants and toddlers, they don't have a voice and they don't have language. And thankfully, the encounter I had, our little 2-year-old within our larger family at 3 was able to verbalize exactly what happened. And to the mother's point, when she was 3, she says, "I don't like so-and-so." And that's where the conversation started. And then a very attuned adult said, "Why don't you like that person?" And that's where the story came out. So mother's guts are very important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Evans, for letting us put you on the spot and share that information with the committee. Any other further discussion from members? Representative West, thank you again. And I know this is it's a difficult lift. And I'm hopeful that there will be a solution along the way here that we can arrive at to ensure that only the safest people get a help in caring for our kids when they're not with us. Closing comments.
Thank you all for being part of Nolan West Day in the judiciary. Audience, this is the number one issue. Clearly, you can see how many bills I have that are closely related to it. This is so far and away what I care about the most. And working on the prevention angle through education in the health committee, teaching people to recognize abuse, had I known how to recognize abuse, the testifiers wouldn't be here, because it would have only been my baby who was abused months before theirs. And then this background goes to prevention. Then there's detection and accountability, which is the cameras. And I also have a bill that was in Chair Moeller's committee on mandatory minimums, reasonable ones, I would say. So trying to hit this at all angles, prevention, detection, and accountability, because we can certainly do better for our kids. And I am deeply thankful to you, Chair Scott, for here. Like, you made it work for me, and I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it.
Glad to help. Representative West, it's such an important issue. With that, the informational hearing on House File 2226 has come to an end, and we want to thank you for being in our committee this morning, Chair West. And thank you to all the testifiers on this really delicate subject and really it's emotional testimony. So thank you to all the testifiers. Next up, we have, a freshman has a bill. Representative Duran, House File 1567 is our next bill. Representative Duran, glad to have you at the testifiers table this morning. And House File 1567 is before us. The motion would be that House File 1567 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes.
Okay, so that is the motion. And I believe we do have an amendment on House File 1567. And that is the A2, members. Would you like to speak briefly to the A2, Representative Duran?
Yes, Madam Chair. So the A2 amendment, what it's doing from the original bill here is it's separating the judiciary and public police officers. So it's creating a separate area in Chapter 13 for public safety officers' data in there. And then, you know, it also comes with protecting personal information, written notification requirements, and then I was hoping Mr. Hopkins can actually go through the exclusion part of it, because I know there's a little bit of concern with that, so I was hoping that nonpartisan would be able to help me kind of explain that, where the exclusions are, where we're done here.
Representative Duran, are the exclusions in the A1, or are they in the body of the base bill?
They're in the A2. The section A2? Shall okay. not, you know.
Okay. All right. Let's go to Mr. Hopkins real quickly for members.
Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins. Madam Chair and members, so the A2 amendment, primarily, so a lot of these protections already exist for judicial officials. The legislature passed them last year. This is creating a new set of statutes that applies basically the same kinds of protections to peace officers. What the amendment does is, rather than add on to the existing data practices section regarding judicial officials, it creates a mirror statute that's specific to public safety officers. And like the existing statute for judicial officials, you can see at 1.21 down to 1.24, or actually 2.2 of the amendment, those are exclusions for personal information contained in real property records. Those exclusions also exist in the judicial official statute as well.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Any other member questions on the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A2, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The A2 is amended on to House File 1567. To the bill, Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Today I would like to present to you House File 1567, a bill that's set to assist with the safety of public officers and correctional officers' private data. Last biennium, a similar bill was passed allowing for judicial officers' information to be more protected. This bill seeks to add peace officers and correctional officers to the list. The role of the peace officers and correction officers is to serve and protect our communities, often putting their lives at risk to uphold the law. As this complexity of modern society evolves, so do the challenges that officers face. This is particularly concerning with their safety and security with the rise of digital technology. Protecting personal data has become paramount within our society. Ensuring privacy and safety of peace officers and correction officers is not only a safeguard of their well-being, but also fortifies public safety. Peace officers and correction officers are increasingly becoming targets of criminal and malicious actors. In an age where information can be accessed or leaked online, personal data about peace officers, including home addresses, phone numbers, and family details, can lead to targeted threats, high-profile cases of doxing, and the act of revealing previously private personal information demonstrates the potential danger faced by officers when their data is compromised. By implementing strict data protection measures, officers can mitigate these risks to work to better serve our community. I myself have been a victim of this issue. It is a very serious issue, and we don't understand the emotional, physical, or potential physical harm, or psychological and potential physical harm it can cause to our family members. This is a big piece for law enforcement. So my family suffered a little bit when we got our information put on the internet. And not only did I have to worry about my own protection while I was at work, but I had to worry about their protection as well. So we need to understand the severity of that. So safety and security of peace officers and correction officers are paramount to the effective function of any community. As officers face increasingly sophisticated threats, it's essential that their personal data is protected vigorously. By prioritizing data privacy, law enforcement agencies can create a safer environment for their officers. Protecting the data of those who serve the community is not only a safeguard for the individuals involved, but is a critical component of maintaining public trust and safety. Together, we can ensure peace officers and correction officers can focus on their mission of serving and protecting without compromising their safety and vulnerable data. Thank you, and I'll pass it off to a testifier.
Thank you, Representative Duran. To the testifier, Mr. Potts, go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Potts. I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We represent roughly 300 police chiefs across the state and a few hundred command staff members that work in those agencies. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Chiefs Association, but also the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. I want to thank the author of the bill. Chiefs Association and the Sheriffs Association support this because it's not uncommon for public officials or public safety officials, police officers and correctional officers, to be harassed, to be threatened, to be stalked, solely because of their position as a police officer or correctional officer. And this bill helps provide some personal data protection similar to judges, actually same as judges, and actually very similar to the protections that you all are provided under the Minnesota Data Government Data Practices Act as elected officials. Again, this is not uncommon for personal information to be leaked and posted online. In fact, it actually it happened to me. I know the author shared his story. I'll share a very quick story. And most of you know my career was with the Bloomington Police Department. I spent nearly 30 years there, the last 12 as the police chief prior to taking this position. And during my time there, personal data was posted online. It was obtained through the property records system in the county that I live. Death threats, other harassment took place online. In one case, some of our police officers conducted a traffic stop. They issued a citation to an individual who claimed to be a sovereign citizen who didn't feel that local police officers had the authority to issue a citation. So in retaliation for receiving a citation, he filed liens on the police officers that conducted the traffic stop, their supervisor, and myself. He obtained information online, personal data. Those liens were for $10 million for each of us, although I had no involvement in the traffic stop. In that case, that individual was criminally charged. This case took place about 5 years ago. We're still dealing with it. The case is not fully resolved, and the officers and myself are still subject to negative financial implications related to the $10 million lien that was placed on a fraudulent lien, I might add, that was placed on all of us. So, again, I want to say thank you to Representative Badal for bringing this forward. It's not uncommon. This stuff is happening all the time. I'm just one. The author's one of many hundreds, if not thousands, of our public safety officials that have had this type of activity directed at them. So on behalf of the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, we support the bill and want to thank the author for bringing it forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Potts. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, we will move to member questions. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran, for all the conversations we've had about your bill. As you know, at your first stop in public safety, I generally support the idea of protecting officer information and, you know, hope that we can get there in a way that makes sense and actually is meaningful. And as you know, as discussed, we passed the bill to offer protections to judges. Last year, knowing we would have to come back to address the property records issue, because that's the primary information that somebody needs protected is where they live with their family. And so that's what a whole group of folks have been working really, really diligently on for the last year. I'm still making some final tweaks to it so we can get that going this year. And so my concern with your bill as it is amended is that it does put a mechanism in place where someone could fill out a form so that if they're essentially doxxed, they can mandate that information be then removed, right? But we're not getting to the point of having somebody having the ability to fill out a form and get their property records, become private. And so I just want to really highlight and stress that because that to me is the most important piece of protection is getting the property records, secured so they can't be accessed. And I know that throughout this process then, the property records, again, getting those secured is a major concern for counties. And I completely understand and I'm empathetic to the concern. It's not a large enough concern for me to not go forward with my bill. I want to make that clear because I want to protect information. That's my goal. But recognizing that it is a whole lot of work for counties, even with the limited group that already exists in law. And so as we move forward in this process, I just want to, you know, be on the record that there are thousands more people that would be covered with the passage of your bill. And we're already getting a lot of pushback with the current group of people who are covered. And again, that's not to demean the necessity of your bill, just acknowledging the process of trying to get this sort of patchwork laws together so that it's actually functional for people. I don't know that I, you know, have a question for you, but just so that folks know, this has been an ongoing conversation. There are some hurdles that you'll continue to go through if this does pass. I'm happy to share that information with you. But just so folks know where we're at, I think both of our caucuses have had a little bit of heartburn just in general of increasing the number of people that this protection would apply to. Like I said, there's members of both caucuses who have questions about that. And there's members of both caucuses who want to increase who this applies to. So this is a continued conversation, I understand. And whether or not, you know, we fully agree with the language in front of us today, I'm fine with, you know, going along with the motion to refer it to public safety. I'm not going to try to trap your bill in judiciary. But I just want to make sure we're all on the same page with sort of where the larger scope of this is. And I appreciate that all the conversations we've had.
Thank you, Representative Curran. I'm just wondering if we could go to House Research, to Mr. Hopkins, and see if he could comment about the bill before us and the issues that Representative Curran brought up.
So, Madam Chair and members, so like the existing statutes that apply to judicial officials, this bill would exempt the personal information protection if the personal information is contained in real property records maintained by, like, county registers. So both the judicial information protections that are currently in law and the protections for peace officers that are in this bill would not apply to real property records.
Thank you. Next on the list, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your bill, Representative. And correct me if I'm wrong, House Research, but these protections are not provided to legislators. We don't have these protections. I'm very sorry for the doxing that has happened to you. Being doxed is terrible. It's happened to me many times. It happened to me several times during my first year in office and then many more times my second year. It's a terrible thing. And I support this protection for our law enforcement officers, and I support this protection for our judges. And I think I have a bigger problem potentially with the idea that this might continue to be our solution to what is a cultural problem that we can't really stop, which is that all of our data is available to everyone. And if someone wants to dox us, they just will. So I would just ask us to reflect as we go forward, like, what other communities are going to get this? What other professions do we think deserve this? Like, it kind of just goes on and on, because there are bad actors who want us to be harmed. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle we're on. People do these things to us. And when I tried to take corrective action, you know, we don't have these protections. So I just want to make sure that that's on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to directly respond to that and expound upon it. This is a conversation that we've been having in the legislature, been having it with Representative Frazier, other representatives on your side of the aisle. We're probably not going to be able to make deadline with anything this year, but we're going to do something about this that does provide protections to literally everybody, because you're right, it is a huge problem. It is transcends partisan differences. We cannot allow people to not feel safe in their own homes. So thank you for bringing that up.
Any other member discussion? Representative, or Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And this is obviously one of those difficult issues, like so many that we deal with in this committee, where we're balancing openness in society versus protection of data. And I certainly see that law enforcement officers have a particular need for protection, that they're particularly it's sort of like who has a job that makes people mad, where they know who's making them mad, right, and maybe want to go after that person. So I think, you know, judges absolutely need that. And I think police officers, law enforcement, you know, including the corrections officers, are definitely in that category. But I also do have the concern that Representative Finke talked about. I think it's shared by many of us, kind of how do we best deal with this issue? And I'm not sure that the best way to deal with it overall, and I'm not saying I'm opposed to your bill, because I do see the need. But, you know, how are we as a society going to really deal with this issue? And I see in the bill that you've got the doxing, the criminal penalty, the crime that you're creating here. And I'm glad that you're working at it from that angle, and I'm glad it's going to public safety. I want to point out that there's some difference in language between what you're doing here and what is the anti-doxing crime for the judges. And so I think we need to be consistent, and I'm glad in public safety you all can wrestle with that and work that out to make sure that there's consistency there. Because in the in this one, you've got in the judicial, for the one for judges, it has to be with intent to threaten, intimidate, harass, or physically injure. And in this one, I think there's no intent element that's intending the consequence. Anyway, this is all to be worked out in public safety, but I just wanted to put a flag in that and say that the idea that anyone's family should be targeted and put at risk because they're doing their job, whether they do it well or poorly, nobody's family, nobody themselves, but certainly nobody's family should be put at risk because of the work they do. I mean, that just should be off the table. But I kind of wonder whether we aren't going to be better off ultimately dealing with that on the criminal side and making it easier, say, to remove a false filing and, you know, getting at it more from that angle rather than ultimately trying to, like, keep everybody's data under lock and key, because I just don't know where the end of that is. How, you know, I guess I would ask you, Representative Duran, I don't know if you've thought about this, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but have you kind of thought about who else and where this would stop if we include police officers? And no one's arguing that they don't need the protection, but who else might need it and who might not need it? Have you given any thought to that?
Representative Duran.
There has been lots of conversations around that particular topic there. Where does it end? You know, and this is a great start to a larger problem that we need to look at. And as long as we keep chipping away at this problem, little by little, I think we're going to be heading in the right direction. But right now, and what we need, just because of the atmosphere with law enforcement around this state right now, is we need to start looking at protecting our law enforcement a little bit more and showing from the legislature's stance right now that we do support our law enforcement, that we do need to look at, showing them that we are caring about them. Because right now the temperature around that particular subject is not really a good atmosphere. And we, I think this has been multiple, brought up multiple conversations of, yes, where does this end? And, you know, as of right now, this is a good beginning, a good starting point for us to fix a lot of things that have occurred within this realm. And then we can start speaking outwards and finding those other solutions to those problems. Because we've talked about prosecutions, you know, prosecutors, and where does that begin? You know, probation officers, you know, where and then what? You know, because they're dealing with, you know, their prosecutors are the ones making sure that these individuals are not, you know, these bad individuals are not coming back out to our streets. And, you know, the probation officers are dealing with some of these individuals that are getting out. So, you know, there is, and I'm glad to work with anybody if any more bills want to come up and the protection of those areas, because I believe that is something that is needed. But, you know, this is a great start for us to show our law enforcement that we support them. So.
Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And so I do recognize that law enforcement is a very difficult job. I mean, it is a difficult job there. And there are lots of things that people do that are very difficult. But I do just want to say, Representative Duran, that, and maybe this is obvious to a lot of people, but I don't think that it's a partisan issue supporting whether we support police.
No.
And I hope you're not suggesting that, because obviously we've seen on both sides that there's been some pretty big disrespect to police, one of them being the president pardoning people who went after police and beat them and did all kinds of horrible things to police officers, and then they were pardoned by President Trump. So, I mean, nobody owns being respectful to police and respecting police, and I just want to put that out there. And whether this is a good way to protect police or a road we want to go down or isn't, I don't think it's about whether anybody, particularly in either party, is respectful of police or appreciates police. I don't know anybody, frankly, in my party, in my caucus, in this legislature, who doesn't understand that police have a really difficult job and respect the job that police do. I really don't. People have different, you know, views about how, you know, there's always a spectrum of how people believe that we should regulate or, you know, there's all of that, but there is no one who doesn't understand that police put themselves in a difficult position every day and are at risk. So we all want to do that. This might be a good way to do it. As I said before, I certainly see the need for this particular profession as opposed to, you know, but I also am concerned about, you know, the direction that we're going here and whether it's a really, you know, makes sense as a society to be locking down everybody's data as opposed to going after people who are intentionally targeting and doing it in that way. So anyway, conversation be continued. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Chair Liebling. And we are running up against the clock here. Representative Duran, final comments.
No, I really appreciate the work that the input that everybody is brought to me and the concerns. You know, we're also going to work on those a little bit more, and you know, we're going to work through this bill to get it through, and hopefully I'll have all your guys' support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Duran. With that, I will, or Representative Duran renews his motion that House File 1567 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Duran. And I will need to have Vice Chair Hudson to take the seat here.
We will be laying over House File 1986, so I will move to place the bill before us. Chair Scott, please present us with your bill.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hudson. House File 1986 seeks to address a specific tort equity issue. Minnesota allows third-party lawsuit funding, has a long statute of limitations, entertains frivolous class action lawsuits, and suffers from a number of other problems, which land us on the Americans for Tort Reform's judicial hellhole list with regularity, even citing this statute specifically. House File 1986 would allow juries to more fully understand the facts of a crash between a commercial truck and a passenger vehicle, which leads to injury. Current law disallows jurors from understanding the relationship between the injury sustained in the crash and their use or lack thereof of a seatbelt. There is no arguing that wearing a seatbelt
makes a big difference if you're involved in a crash. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, seatbelts reduce the risk of fatal injury by 45% for front seat passengers and 60% for those in pickup trucks and SUVs. These numbers highlight the critical role that seatbelts play in vehicular safety. According to the National Safety Council, of the occupants who survived car accidents, those wearing seatbelts survived 85.54% of the time, as opposed to the unrestrained surviving only 14.46% of the time. What we do know is that the cost for Minnesota businesses continues to go up, and provisions in law like this one set the table for what are called nuclear verdicts. A nuclear verdict is defined as an exceptionally high jury award that surpasses what should be a reasonable or rational amount. Some define a nuclear verdict award as being any penalty that exceeds $10 million, while others would put the threshold of a nuclear verdict at a much higher or more disproportionate number. In these types of cases, personal injury lawyers go after the deepest pockets. The existing statute here has been on the books since 1999. Minnesota's primary seatbelt law was passed in 2009, and according to our own Minnesota Department of Public Safety's 2024 survey, the percentage of people buckling up has reached a 10-year high in 2024 of 94.7%. More than 15 years after the law first required us to buckle up, it is past time to change this law. It is my hope that we can level the playing field for all parties involved in tragic accidents. With me to go into more detail are John Hosladen, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and Paul Hopewell, partner at Erickson, Zierke, Kaduer, and Madsen. Thank you.
Mr. Hosladen, go ahead and state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Hosladen, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I am here today to testify in support of House File 1986, a bill repealing the so-called seatbelt gag rule. We do believe that repealing this law will further encourage Minnesotans to take their own safety into account while driving and continue to make our roads safer. As mentioned, Paul Hopewell will be tag-teaming with me here today. I think it's important to stress at the outset that safety is not simply a priority for the trucking industry, because a priority is something that changes or shifts as customers and economies do the same. No, safety is a bedrock value of trucking companies that never changes. From the drivers we put behind the wheel to the equipment we put on the road, safety is the filter that we use to make every decision. And I have to tell you, these are truly personal decisions. Over 95% of the trucking companies in existence have 10 or fewer trucks, and most are family-owned businesses. These family businesses know that the person sharing the road with their driver is someone's mother or father or son or daughter. The last call that any one of these trucking companies wants to receive is one informing them that their truck was involved in a serious or fatal crash. And that is why trucking fleets are voluntarily, without government mandates, adding safety technology to their trucks, from automatic emergency braking systems to lane-keeping technology to forward-facing event cameras. Telematics data collected by these systems is sent to fleet managers as it happens and is used for in-the-moment coaching. Trucking is also one of the most highly regulated industries operating today. Federal regulations strictly govern the condition of the equipment, the qualifications of the driver, the hours a driver may be behind the wheel, and they mandate drug and alcohol testing. All drivers today are tracked with electronic logging devices that can be monitored remotely by the fleet, and performance results of both the fleet and driver are also tracked by a federal scoring system known as Compliance Safety and Accountability. These CSA scores are available real-time to both law enforcement and the fleet. And yet, despite our best efforts, with the best drivers, the best equipment, the best technology, according to the American Automobile Association, the critical factor leading to the crash was attributed to the passenger vehicle driver in over 75% of the time. And while the technology and the accountability of trucking companies have changed dramatically, one thing has not, and that is the state seatbelt gag rule. Originally passed way back in 1963 and then modified, prohibiting evidence of whether a motorist was wearing the seatbelt during an accident from being admitted in court. Now, there were several justifications way back when. First, seatbelts were not yet mandatory, and there was no broad consensus that wearing them made people safer. And second, Minnesota used the principle of contributory negligence in evaluating a plaintiff's claim. So we think back to that point. If a jury found a plaintiff even 1% at fault for their accident, they were completely barred from recovering damages. The gag rule offered plaintiffs some procedural protection by removing the question of seatbelt use entirely.
Mr. Houselight, I'll need you to wrap up if you can.
But almost 60 years later, things have changed. Seatbelts are mandatory. The statistics show that they promote safety, and we no longer follow the rule of contributory negligence. We've replaced it with comparative fault, which allows a plaintiff's recovery to be reduced proportionately to their fault rather than barring them from recovery. And finally, we've made failure to wear a seatbelt a primary traffic offense. So why have one law on the books criminalizing the non-use of seatbelts and another that removes the mere fact of seatbelt use from the legal process altogether? So with that, I'd like to, Mr. Chair, turn it over to Paul Hopewell.
Mr. Hopewell, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Hopewell, and I work at the law firm Erickson, Zierke, Cooter in Madison. I represent individuals and companies in the state of Minnesota who are involved in motor vehicle accidents. I am here to support House File 1986, a bill repealing the so-called seatbelt gag rule. The seatbelt gag rule has outlived its original justification and its continued existence. It harms litigants, undermines the truth of the seeking of functions of civil trials, and prevents Minnesota juries from hearing relevant evidence and making informed decisions regarding negligence. The seatbelt gag rule prevents defendants from presenting evidence relevant to a plaintiff's claimed injuries, comparative fault, their duty to mitigate damages of their claims. It even can prevent, at times, a plaintiff from requesting damages for an injury because they were injured due to a seatbelt. So it harms plaintiffs and damages, or plaintiffs and defendants both. These results are unjust and harm both plaintiffs and defendants. Contrary to the dire predictions of the other side, the bar, the people who want to continue have this, the sky will not fall if the seatbelt gag rule is repealed. States like Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, and Oregon allow the use of seatbelt evidence, but place caps on possible reduction in damages. States like New York and California allow unlimited evidence regarding seatbelt evidence. The artificial restriction in Minnesota makes little sense in the modern world because today upwards of 90% of the people use seatbelts. I can't get out of the driveway without having my daughters tell me to put my seatbelt on. It's something that is ingrained in us early on that it is negligent if we do not do so. We are able to use evidence of speeding, intoxication, cell phone use, and that's not prohibited in civil cases here in Minnesota. And there's no reason why that Minnesota seatbelt evidence shouldn't be used the same. Allowing a jury to consider seatbelt evidence is not victim blaming. It is simply asking the jury to take all of the considerations of fault, who was at fault, who is negligent, into consideration. It is important to note that repealing the seatbelt gag rule will not automatically render the seatbelt evidence admissible in every case. That will come down to Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure and different evidentiary issues. In cases where seatbelt evidence is admitted, it would be considered by the members of the jury, which we all want to do, to have them consider everything in the amongst them. There is nothing unique about seatbelt evidence that would overwhelm a juror. Again, we teach our children from the very beginning to put their seatbelts on, And if one does not do so, we believe that that is negligent, and the jury should consider that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has.
Thank you, Mr. Holquill. I have two other testifiers on the list. Is Joel Carlson in the room? And given our limited amount of time, I'm going to ask you to keep it to about a minute and a half. Once you're seated, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And we are a professional association of attorneys that represent people across the state of Minnesota when they're involved in injuries that are the result of someone else's negligence. And I'm happy to be here every day, but I was particularly happy to be here for Nolan West Day. We've had members that have handled those cases. They are extremely compelling. We have a lot of problems with family and group daycare, and I appreciate you giving it the attention that it deserves. I want to talk briefly about the public policy here that has been in place since 1963 at the request of the insurance industry and the auto manufacturers because they didn't know if seatbelts were going to work. They absolutely do work. They're safe, they're effective, and we have about 95% of the people that use them in Minnesota. Women use them a little more than men, and particularly young men, and that's a different problem. But to give you the scope of what we're talking about here, about 150,000 Minnesotans are involved in automobile accidents each year. That's about 123,000 vehicles. There are 24,000 injury accidents in Minnesota every year, and about 3,300 of them are alcohol-related. Many are the result of distracted driving, bad conditions, speeding, but you won't find from the Department of Public Safety a single instance where a lack of use of a seatbelt caused an accident. They want to use this evidence as it goes to liability to deny you a recovery. And that's why they want to repeal this evidentiary rule. It doesn't have anything to do with increasing seatbelt use. The NHTSA says the best way to do that is to have seatbelts a primary offense. We've had that for two decades. We've had seatbelts as a mandatory requirement, the same number of as this bill. 1986 is when we required Minnesotans to wear seatbelts in 1986. I have a number of examples of how this evidence used against an injured party can deny them a complete recovery. A few states allow it as it relates to a mitigation of damages, and Mr. Yagvall can talk about that. But Mr. Chair and members, this is really unfair to people. This is not just seatbelts, by the way. It's child restraint systems as well. You can use that evidence to deny a recovery to a child who may be injured in an automobile accident through no fault of their own. This totally benefits insurance companies and truckers when the injured party is at no fault of their own, when they're run into, like we had 2 years, 3 years ago in St. Cloud, where a trucker never tapped the brakes and ran into the back end of an Uber truck, two people killed. The people in the back seat weren't belted, and they would use this evidence that had nothing to do with causing that accident to deny their recovery. We think it's unfair. We could go on a long time, Mr. Chair, but we won't.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for your time. We appreciate
Mr. Yagfeld, please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Jake Yagfeld. I'm a private practice attorney here in St. Paul, and I've spent the last 17 years representing people who are injured and killed in automobile accidents. So I'm going to try to give you a quick perspective, just a practical perspective on how the seatbelt gag rule affects outcomes in jury trials. I tried a case up in Duluth last July. My client was a backseat passenger in a vehicle who was unbelted, and unfortunately what happened is there was a head-on collision. The driver for the vehicle did nothing wrong, was driving in the right place on the right lane, and another vehicle whose driver was not paying attention swerved into oncoming traffic and caused a head-on. My client was significantly injured. She was not wearing a seatbelt and admitted that fact at the scene, told the police that. She was not cited for that, even though that we know that that's a primary offense here in Minnesota. And so in the seatbelt gag rule, essentially what happens is the jury evaluates the evidence that's relevant to determining who's responsible for the cause of the collision, which brings about the harm. The use or non-use of a seatbelt plays no role in whether or not the collision happens, as Mr. Carlson had mentioned. So that's an important factor, which will conflate and confuse juries on that issue. understandable why, as a defense, it would be useful to help diminish a claim. But the practical reality is it harms injured people who did nothing wrong to cause the collision. Secondarily, there's a defense that's called mitigation of damages, which can be used to argue about whether a person acted reasonably once they were harmed. Did they act reasonably? And was their injury prolonged or worsened because of stuff they did after they were injured? I think the key word there is after. The injury occurs as a result of someone's negligence in causing a collision. And so if they do something stupid, like they go on a skydiving trip after neck and back injuries and further hurt themselves, that is an argument the defense can raise to diminish the damages of that injured party, which they should be able to do. So Minnesota law has been functioning perfectly fine with that in play. And so just as a practitioner who deals with this daily, and again, I'm representing people from all walks of life and all sides of the aisle, I think you leave well enough alone from our perspective. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, can I give you one more statistic, please, from the Minnesota Supreme
Court? We are unfortunately completely out of time.
That's fine.
And as a result, we're going to forego member discussion at this point. We're laying the bill over. When it comes back, we can have member discussion on it. I'll give closing comments to Chair Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Hudson. And I want to just point out that this bill does not mean that this is the sole deciding factor in damages. And to say that juries wouldn't be able to figure this out, well, other juries in Wisconsin, Iowa, other states have figured it out on how to parse this through. And I think our jurors are just as smart, if not smarter, than those states. And so, members, I would like your consideration on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Scott. And testifiers, with that, House File 1986 is laid over. That is the continuation of our business. The meeting is adjourned.